This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Bill Meeks at Meeks Mixed Media, maximizing brands large and small in the new media space on the web at meeksmixedmedia.com. And by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations on the web at violetusa.com. And by Digital Media Technology, supplying professional broadcast equipment to Hong Kong and mainland China on the web at dmtpro.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
What are you holding, Scott?
It gives me the opportunity to pretty much have an entry ticket into just about any facility that I want to go see.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business,
or in a choice hotel in a distant land,
this is Kirk Harnack.
On this episode, Chris Tobin joins us from Manhattan, and we finally got Scott Feibusch to be with us. Yay!
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Joining us today, Chris Tobin from New York City. Chris is with the CBS radio stations there. And our special guest today is Scott Feibusch at Feibusch.com. Scott chronicles what's going on in broadcasting in the northeast part of the United States with his Northeast Radio Watch. You can link to that from Feibusch.com. And Scott publishes a beautiful calendar every year packed with pictures of towers. So if you're really in the towers, you're going to want to check that out also at Feibusch.com. We had a couple of technical difficulties both at the beginning and during the show, so kind of struggle through that with us. Bear with us, and we joined the show already in progress.
All right.
Here we go.
Back to Scott. And Scott, that leads me to a question for you. Does the top of the Empire State Building count as a tower for your purposes?
It absolutely does, no question about it. In fact, it has been featured multiple times on my website, on Tower Site of the Week. It's been in the calendar. We've had it there four times square also. There's another site. You got to get John Lyons on the show at some point. Get him on with you to talk about all the work that he's done there. But, yeah, absolutely. Tops of buildings definitely count.
Wow. Wow. Now let's get to the subject at hand this week, which is towers. Scott Feibusch, you have something to do with some reporting on radio stations in the Northeast, Northeast Radio Watch. Give us the quick one paragraph about what that is all about.
That is a weekly publication now in its, I believe, 16th year, which is kind of frightening, actually, chronicling everything that's happening in radio in the northeastern U.S., and in eastern Canada, so everywhere from Pennsylvania, New Jersey, up through New York, into New England, and from Ontario, east into the Maritimes, and if it's happening in engineering, if it's happening in programming, business side of things, station sales, you name it, it gets covered.
Now, people can get to the Northeast Radio Watch site, I guess, from your main site, which is Feibusch.com, Feibusch.com. And so the things about your website, what you do there, pretty much on a, well, it seems full-time, I'm sure, basis. Let's talk about those things today. Tell us about what Feibusch.com is and what is this fascination with towers and, you know, what can people find out when they visit Feibusch.com?
The fascination with towers, I think, began when I was a kid. I grew up surrounded by AM directional arrays. I had a three-tower self-supporting array almost literally right in my backyard. Another four-tower array about half a mile south of me, and then two more arrays within another mile and a half or thereabouts. So I grew up surrounded by these things, and yeah, curious growing up, you want to know, what is this? What does it do? Why are there all these towers? Why are they in this sort of configuration? And I grew up fascinated by it. It was always something that interested me. And when I started working in radio, not on the engineering side of things, but actually in the news side of things, I still have a foot in that business. I started to get to know the engineers. And I realized, you know, this in some ways is actually more interesting than writing or reading an hourly newscast. And so that's sort of how I ended up over on that side of the aisle.
Gotcha. So you have a background in news reporting. You mean like live on air news reporting?
Yes. Yes, I worked at WBZ in Boston, mostly off air there. I did TV for a few years, frighteningly enough, back home here in Rochester at what was then called Our News, the Time Warner 24-hour cable news network. And for about the last 6 years, I've been working part-time at our NPR station here in Rochester at WXXI, and I fill in anchoring newscasts there when they need me, and I do a weekly segment there called Mixed Media, which is a weekly segment all about, surprise, surprise, media and technology.
Hey, Scott, we're going to be examining your tower site of the week, which is really a story about a radio station. That's WNYC in New York. Chris, I know you've been acquainted with Scott Feibusch for years and years. How is Feibusch's work viewed in the industry? What I mean, I once in a while I go to his website and find out about some tower. How do your engineering friends use Scott's information, whether it's the calendar or the website or the stories that he writes?
Oh, one, it's excitement. Two, it's on the same level as the old days of radio and records for the programming folks. That was, if you want to call it the oracle of information for the industry. Scott's calendar, website, people talk about, I know the guys at my facility, once in a while will drop an email to the group and say, hey, did you check out the latest? Here's what's going on. So I'd say, it's high up there. If you're a person that does a lot of information gathering and aggregating, Scott's website is part of it, at least for engineering with the group in New York with me. And I know just the other day somebody mentioned they picked up a new calendar and was walking it around the office. So if that's any indication.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the calendar in depth toward the end of the show. I got a couple of questions about that. Like, Scott, how do you pick the centerfold? hey, Scott, on your website, you've got a really good story here about a station that I've been to before, but not to the new location. And let's chat about this one, because you've done a marvelous story on the website, and you've got a great selection of photos. If people want to see, a major radio station and the facilities before and after, and they moved to a new location. This is certainly a story that people would be interested in looking at. So, Scott, tell us a bit about this WNYC, about finding out about their move, and maybe you can give us some history, first of all, of their old location, the municipal building in downtown Manhattan.
Absolutely. Let's back up for a second. WNYC segment is actually one feature of the site that's called Tower Site of the Week. That surprise, surprise features a broadcast facility every week. And it can be anything from an individual tower somewhere to a massive rebuild of an existing studio facility, as is the case with WNYC. This was some neat history there. WNYC was the city-owned radio station in New York City. They went on the air from the municipal building, which is this enormous 32-story Gothic pile of a building in Lower Manhattan, right across the street from New York City Hall. They signed on from there in 1924, and I mean signed on from there. Studios were there. There was a long wire antenna up on the roof of the building. That was where WNYC was. And they eventually moved the AM transmitter. It went out to a site called Greenpoint in Brooklyn, and then eventually over to New Jersey with all the other AMs. And they put an FM on the air from the municipal building. In fact, Major Armstrong himself signed the FM on the air from the municipal building. And then that eventually moved to the Empire State Building in the 60s, and then to World Trade, then back to Empire. That's a story unto itself right there. But the studios stayed put in the municipal building for all these years. They moved around from one end of the floor to the other, but they were essentially at the same address from 1924 until just, I think it was 08, when they finally moved out. The station was no longer city-owned. It was purchased by a nonprofit group. And they needed new studio facilities. It was, Kirk, you said you were up there. The municipal building facility was way overgrown. It had been built for what had essentially been sort of a music station with some talk pieces to it, and not for a station that grew into what they do now, which is producing shows for NPR, producing shows for Public Radio International. And they were scattered all over the building. There were people on every floor from 24 up to 32. There were offices. I remember finding part of their news staff working out of what had been a men's room, with one of those self-enclosed little studio pods inside what had been a men's room with the stalls ripped out of it. So they needed a change desperately, and boy, did they get one!
Did they do something about the acoustics?
They did. They used one of those little prefab. I forget which vendor they got it from, but one of those little prefab voice booths. So they stuck it in there, and inside one of those, nobody knows you're in a men's room, obviously.
Yeah, okay, right.
Something they took
the men's sign down from the door, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, believe it or not, it was one of those old-fashioned, 1920s glass doorways that still had the lettering on the glass. I remember that. Yeah. I think it was still there. So I have to see if I got a picture of that one or not. So they move.
If anybody on the, watching the live stream here or later on the podcast, we'll have this link on the podcast, wants to go to the website, fivebush.com, and click on the website, the tower site of the week. And there's some great pictures here, including this picture of the municipal building. If you've never seen this in Manhattan, in lower Manhattan, a building I've walked by a number of times. If you're a tourist in New York, there's if you go anywhere near Wall Street and downtown area, that you're going to walk past this building. And it's quite a gorgeous building with porticos, and I'm not sure what you'd call them, walkways on the first floor of the building that you can go through. And there's a beautiful area behind the building. So it's quite a classic old building. And it's, sure, it's been in a lot of movies and TV shows. So the WNYC was up near the top, if not at the top floors of this building. I'm sorry, Scott, go ahead.
It wasn't. And actually, it's funny you should mention the very top floors. There's a spire that goes up the very top with these narrow little floors that are maybe 25 feet across with a stairwell running up the middle of them. And one of the interesting things about WNYC, it is, they think, and I think they're right about this, the only radio station in America with its own full-time archivist. They've got a guy there named Andy Lancet, whose full-time job is to maintain the history of WNYC. And they've got lots of history going back to the days of transcription discs and all of this. And he was working, when I first met him, way up at the top of this spire. It was like going up to find the mad scientist up in his lair. And there's a picture on the site of Andy up there, just surrounded by these shelves that were bulging full of transcription discs and reel-to-reel tapes. And he had wire recordings up there. And you name the format, it existed somewhere up there, way overstuffed, nowhere near enough room to work. He had a couple of part-timers working with him, and they had to almost, make a schedule of who would go past whom to just get past each other to get to the other side of the room to do their work. So they were well overdue for a new home. And that in and of itself is something of a story. They wanted to stay in Lower Manhattan. They felt a real strong tie to Lower Manhattan. And they found space in what had been an old printing plant down in what's called the Hudson Square Network, Hudson Square neighborhood, rather, an area that Chris is all too familiar with these days. And they found space on the 7th, 8th, and 9th floor of this building. And over the course of about a year and a half, I had a chance through the good graces of the folks at WNYC to visit with them several times as they moved and to chronicle that whole process of building out this space and creating a state-of-the-art broadcast facility in some very, very old space.
Hey, Chris, as a New York City engineer, how tight-knit is the New York City engineering community? In other words, when this project was being talked about and planned and things were moving and getting built, are other engineers in the city aware of this? Did it affect you or your operations, or do you have some friends who are in there doing all this work?
Oh, yes. The community in New York City, the engineering folks, is quite close. And it's a professional courtesy on many occasions because we share a lot of similar resources for a transmitter facility primarily, and studios from time to time. You need a quick help, an emergency, everyone lends a hand because you expect that in return. Yeah, during that project, everybody was aware of it. A lot of folks would stop in, see the progress, check on the gang and see how they're coming along, and then learn from them any mistakes or obstacles they didn't expect in the paper design when they actually apply it. The same is true for my project we had, which is about two blocks away from WNYC in the Hudson Square neighborhood. And everybody's close. I mean, it's closer than you'd expect because of the competition or the competitive environment that we have in New York City.
So, Scott, take us through now a bit more of the progress of WNYC and their move. Were there any really, innovative things that they were able to incorporate in the new place that they couldn't do in the old place?
Oh, there was a lot that they couldn't do in the old place. I mean, one of the things they didn't have in the old place was just, and this is something that isn't even really technology, this is really just sort of a human resources issue. They were producing all sorts of different shows, and nobody on the staff of each show got to know anybody from the staff of any other show very well because they were all in different spaces that were scattered wherever there was room for them anywhere in this building. Yeah. And so just the opportunity to put everybody in one place and to let them all interact with each other was a big deal to begin with. We don't think of that necessarily as being a huge priority, but for them it was just to have everybody in one space. So the way that they set it up, rather than by show, was by function. They said, okay, we have some content that we do that is really urgent, going straight to air sort of content. the hourly newscast that we do, the cut-ins during their flagship shows, during Morning Edition, during All Things Considered. And they've got two daily talk shows. They said, we're going to put these people as close as we can to the air studio. And then the farther away you are from their main cluster of air studios, the less timely, as it were, generally, the content you're producing is. So the people who produce the talk shows are a little farther away, and then the people who produce the other daily shows and the weekly shows are one floor up with their own set of studios that they can use that don't interfere with the daily guys. So just the layout issue was one big thing. Another interesting little quirk of the layout, because it was an old printing plant, there were these enormous concrete columns that they had to work around. And for the most part, they were able to arrange the studios around the columns, but there were points where they just had to squeeze some space in. So there is at least one studio there where you open the door, and about all that you see when you open the door of this little voice booth is a concrete column right in front of you. You sort of have to wriggle around the column to get back to where the console is and where the actual working position is. So there were some compromises that were involved, you know, whenever you're not starting from scratch. That was one consideration. They have a street-level performance space. This is a big deal now in New York City. And we should mention that a bunch of New York City stations, and I'm going to be talking more about these in a couple of future episodes of Tower Side of the Week, that there are a bunch of New York City stations that all moved down to the same neighborhood at about the same time. Amos Broadcasting was down there first. They moved down there about a decade ago. And then CBS and Clear Channel, right about the same time WNYC was moving, were both in the process of taking their facilities, which in the case of Clear Channel had been some of them in various uptown locations, or midtown at least, and some of them across the river in New Jersey. They consolidated in one lower Manhattan location, and CBS consolidated five of their six stations in another facility almost right around the corner from WNYC. So everybody was moving down there all at about the same time, which was great for me because it gives me the opportunity when I go down there to kind of hit everybody at once, you know, go see Jim Stagnito over at WNYC, and then 5 minutes later, I'm out the door two blocks away and visiting with Chris over at CBS. So it makes that part of my job a little easier.
I guess, what's your interest in chronicling this? Is this part of your Northeast Radio Watch work, or is this part of the tower work, or a bit of both?
It's a little bit of both. Some of it actually goes back to my academic training. I was a history major in college. One of the things I've always been particularly fascinated by is the history of the medium. And, you know, we work in a tremendously impermanent medium. Once it's broadcast, it's gone. A little different now, maybe with podcasts, but generally, you know, we send something out into the ether and it's gone unless there's somebody crazy enough to pile up stacks of air checks worth of whatever you've done. But those people are few and far between. And so you do something and it's gone. A station goes off the air and, you know, it's like it was never there almost. I kind of figured from the beginning, somebody's got to chronicle some of this. And I got to know some of the other people who were doing it, and I realized that there was sort of a gap. You know, there were people who were writing about what WABC was doing in the 60s. There were not a lot of people who were writing about what the stations in New York or anywhere were doing 5 years ago. And I thought that deserved to be preserved. There's a lot of good work going on out there. A lot of the people, like Chris, who are doing it in the heat of the moment are just too busy to worry about preserving it for the future. So I figured, hey, this is something I can do. I've been working very, very slowly on a history of New York City FM radio, going from the earliest days of Major Armstrong up roughly to the present. And it's been chugging along kind of slowly, having two kids in the last few years sort of presented a roadblock for a few years in that. But I've been working on that, so that presented a good excuse to get to know some of these guys and get in and see some of these facilities. And what I found over the years is that just about everybody in the business is really happy to have somebody come along to take these pictures and to document this stuff and to make sure that it's preserved so that in the event somebody cares what this looked like 20 years or 30 years from now, it's out there.
Moving to this new facility from the old place, and I've been to the old place, and it was cramped, crowded, and people were really spread out, and you might have a show right after somebody else's show, and you never meet this person except maybe you bump into them in the hallway. And if your show was a recorded show that you produced sometime early in the week, yeah, you may never meet this person. How does the quality of what goes on the air at WNYC, how has that has that changed with the new facility? And I'm sure when you move in the new place, there's got to be mistakes made because you're not accustomed to, you know, the old fashioned whatever you were doing for years and years. You know, the muscle memory has got to change from pushing this button or that button, or even walking to this office down the hall. But can you tell a difference in the on air product when you move to this brand new $45 million, 72,000 square foot space?
That is probably more a question. If you can get Jim Stagnito on here or Steve Schultes, that's probably a better question for those guys to answer. I think I hear it a little bit. I think it makes some of their weekly shows a little bit more immediate. I know I've seen when I've been up there to visit that they literally have all the producers from all the shows now out in one big cubicle farm. And cubicle farm doesn't even do it justice because the space that they have is this big sunlit area with these enormous overhight glass windows on two sides, looking out over the Hudson River and looking out over lower Manhattan. The facility itself actually is right by the entrance to the Holland Tunnel. And that presents its own set of challenges, obviously, for the soundproofing because you got traffic going by 7 or 8 or 9 floors down. But they've also got the street-level performance space that I started to mention. And this thing is built, the subway line that runs right under it. And I'm blanking now. Chris left film me on which line it is.
That would be the number one train. The number one train.
That's the one that runs right under them. It's a very, very shallow subway line. It's built literally below the surface of the street. So they really had to suspend this performance studio. It floats on these rubber pucks. It is just, you wouldn't know the train is going by. The only way that you'd know is you put your ear right up to the column, and the column transmits a little bit of the noise, but the actual floor of the space is completely separated from the column. So that was a challenge that they had to face. But getting back to the actual content of it, it really, and forgive me, my kids are wandering in here on their way to bed.
We're kid friendly. Hello, kids. Good night. Kiss them good night.
Here, Ari, come over here. Say hello to the Tort family. This is Ari. Say hi.
Hey Ari.
Hi.
Here's Ari and. Here's Eli. There's Eli.
Hey, Eli.
There's Eli.
Good to see you.
Now we're going to send him back down to their mother for get ready for bed.
Do you know the same thing about me?
I'm not makeup on because I have my, I didn't have my recital, but I had my dress rehearsal for my recital.
For dance class, yep.
Awesome. Awesome.
Okay, there goes Eli. We're going to send them off to get to bed here.
Hey, I want to sit on your lap. I didn't do it again.
Yeah, you did. All right. We're talking about radio engineering here in the calendar. Tell people to buy a calendar, huh?
Buy a calendar. There go Ben.
There we go. There's my sales staff.
You guys, this moment brought to you in part by Art Linkletter. Kids say the dumbest things.
Exactly.
In Marriott.
Where was it? Ah, yes. WNYC.
Hey, Scott, while you're at it there, kind of adjust your camera a bit for us, so get more centered, if you would, and leave a little bit more room for your name at the bottom, for the lower third. Wrong way!
Yeah, okay. Hang on here.
That's tough.
My live feet stuck there. There we go.
This is why TV stations have $70,000 cameras, and we don't.
this is why when I was working in TV, I actually had a photojournalist that I worked with, who did all the stuff and got the lighting right and all of that. They didn't trust me with the camera. There was a reason.
And we're just behind the scenes guys. We don't all we're in front of the camera guys. But so anyway, you were before the kids came in to say goodnight.
I've seen you filling in doing weather there in Nashville.
And you know you have a choice. There's four other stations to choose from.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. Anyway. Okay, we'll take Eli out of here, honey. Yeah, come on, please. Okay. Anyway, so where were we? Yeah, WNYC. So you asked about the product and whether or not there's really been a change in the product. And I think arguably there has been, because with everybody all working together in these pods, they have an opportunity to talk about what they're doing, to share guests back and forth, to share story ideas back and forth. And the other thing that they've done that was smart is that they didn't hide the rest of management on a different floor. There's a stairwell that they cut that connects the three floors where they are. And the stairwell goes right by the general manager's office. It goes right by the underwriting offices. And so nobody can hide from anybody. And I think that's pretty neat because it makes everybody accessible to everybody. So that was another important development.
Sounds like even the general manager has to look busy from time to time because people are going by his office.
She's got a big glass window that looks out onto all the staff going by. So the staff kind of has to know what they're doing to get past her office. The other thing that they have.
Okay. Hey, Scott. I'm going to turn our attention to Chris. I got a couple questions for Chris. If you want to take care of the kids and get them nice and settled.
Kids out of the room.
We'll come back to you and just rejoin us when you get back. Hey, Chris. Scott was telling us about this. I'm just really curious about how you get rid of the noise of a subway that's just a few feet below your feet. In your new location, Chris, your CBS facility has been. Did you have a noise problem like that?
No, actually, our building is located a block away from the subway, and it's definitely isolated just by geography alone. Now, noise issues for us from vibration from the subway, not a problem. The way you isolate any studio from noise, actually, back in the early days of television, believe it or not, I mean, radio, let's go back to radio first. The early days of radio, microphones, studios were designed in such a way that the microphone itself was very sensitive, picked up everything. So the rooms had to be built so tight audio-wise that they come up with a way of creating a floating studio, as the term is. You float the studio on hockey pucks, springs with the rubber insulation, and then the walls never touch the outer walls. So it's a box within a box, isolated with air, rubber.
Yeah.
And matter of fact, there were studios I worked at, we had them years ago. You'd walk into the studio and your body, the sensation of motion was gone. I know it's difficult to explain to experience without physically doing it, but if you can, it's like weightlessness. You know, if you're in an airplane that's taking off or landing really quick, and sometimes you feel that certain moment of, wow, my body doesn't feel like it's grounded, if you will. That's what these studios can do. And at WNYC, you're actually looking to get rid of not the noise that we're accustomed to when you're on a subway platform or maybe above the grates along the street, but the vibration, the low frequency vibration. And that's where the rubber hockey pucks, if you will, come into play to isolate the low frequencies. And it's all based on the physics of audio. So they build a box, place the box on top of, say, rubber / springs for support, and then the walls of that box never touch the outside and can be insulated with rubber, air, other substances. There's other synthetic materials. It's wild to walk into a studio that's a floating studio, is the term, and to feel no sensation of motion. Some people actually become uncomfortable.
Do you, when you walk into a room like this, if it's really quiet, I know I've walked into some studios that were very well insulated, and I feel like any thoughts in my head are getting sucked out of my head. Kind of like putting, you know, some noise cancellation headphones on. You feel like the ambient noise is getting sucked out of your head. But here, instead of just the space, you know, next to your ears inside a Bose acoustic canceling headset, you've got the whole room. The whole room is just kind of quiet.
Well, now you're talking about the science of neurology. One of the things that the human brain or the ear, what we do as humans, you know, listening to the environment we're in, the brain processes the audio around it and says, okay, this is stuff it's supposed to be here. I'm going to ignore it so that I can focus on more attention toward what's happening in front of me. So when you walk into a studio that's been isolated, the brain says, wait a minute, where's that ambient noise? What happened to that background chatter that I'm always filtering out of, but just, and then your brain says, well, there's nothing there. Let's open up the auditory canal and say, hey, what else can we find out? What other things are going on? And that's the effect. I know it's probably a little more scientific.
Yeah.
Or not scientific, but that's what it is.
And when it's taken to almost an extreme, this is where you stand in a room that's so quiet, you end up, your ears become more sensitive and you become more aware of what small noises are still around you. And that's when you hear your own heartbeat.
Yes. I actually have a pair of in-ear earbuds that are designed to about 30 dB of attenuation of outside noise. And depending on where I'm at, I can actually hear my pulse.
Sure.
It's nerve-wracking.
Yeah. Hey, Scott Fibers back?
I'm back.
Hey. Okay. Hope the kids are happy and well. I got a kid on the way, another one. I got three grown, and now we've got one on the way. So I'm looking forward to a few years of just what you experienced, you know, every night.
It's the joys of having a home office right next to their bedrooms and doing a show at bedtime. So.
In fact, well, I'm moving my office from where my office is going to be the nursery. We're moving it to the basement. So daddy gets to go to the basement. Yeah.
Oh, fine.
Hey, So, Scott, in this new space, just a bit more now about sound isolation. Are there some studios at WNYC now that are like we were just talking about, so very quiet, they're extremely well insulated? Did they go to that kind of length?
They've been working with it. It's not quite to the extent that Chris was talking about. Being on an upper floor in New York City makes something of a difference, I think, all by itself. But they do have, there's a music performance space that is up on, I believe it's the 8th floor where the main broadcast studios are, that is very well insulated. They've done a lot of work since they moved in. They learned pretty quickly when they moved in that some of the sound treatment that they had wasn't quite enough, that they're going to have to do more. Some of the spaces were quite live when they moved into them. So they've still been tweaking that. I think Jim Stagnito is not 100% there yet, at least the last time I visited him, but he said he's getting there. So they're working on it, and it sounds good. I've heard some of the stuff out of their music performance studio on air, and it sounds quite nice. It's very respectable.
So tell us about the show was ostensibly a little bit about towers. What does WNYC do for a broadcasting tower?
Well, they have an AM and they have two FMs. That was another one of the challenges, is that they acquired a second FM station just after they moved in, and so they had to rethink how their studios were going to be used to make room for WQXR, which, talk about your studios, by the way. WQXR, in its prior incarnation, had been the classical station of the New York Times. And they built one of the last great analog facilities in New York City in the late 80s that was up sort of near Union Square on Fifth Avenue. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful, quiet recording space that is, last I heard, sitting vacant. Nobody's in there right now, which is,
you know,
is a
shame. I've been there. I got to visit Rodney Belazaire, the last engineer there, WQXR, in that space. And you're right. We walked into that space and closed the door, and it was very quiet. And I could see, and the acoustical treatment on the walls, I could tell, was just wonderful for small groups classical instruments. What a beautiful space that was! So they've moved out of something both historic and that worked quite well for a classical radio station broadcaster.
And it was adjustable as well. You could actually flip the panels around on the wall if you wanted a more live sound. You'd flip them around, and you get the hardwood on one side. If you needed something that was a little bit deader, you'd flip it around to the other side, and you'd have some foam on the other side. So it was even adjustable, depending on who was using the space and for what. So it's kind of a shame when those studios went away. But WQXR moved in down with WNYC in that space, so they had to adapt for that. But as for the transmitters, they have a room at Empire now that I actually have yet to get to. They've been so busy doing the studio move over the last few years that I haven't had a chance to catch up with Jim Stagnito to see his transmitters. But I know they're at Empire for both of their FM signals, and then they are out in the New Jersey Meadowlands at a site that's shared with WMCA out in Kearny, New Jersey, a three-tower site for their AM signal on AM 820. And that, I think it's a Nautel transmitter that they're running out there, and I think it's BE's at the sites at Empire. And one of the things that they looked at when they moved was, okay, where can we go where we'll have direct line of sight microwave? They actually had a problem on 9/11. Their FM transmitter, which was at the World Trade Center, obviously was destroyed. They had no way at the time to get audio out to their AM transmitter because the STL path to the AM transmitter also went from the old municipal building studios up to World Trade, and from World Trade by microwave out to New Jersey. What they ended up doing eventually was to go up on the NPR satellite, because they had a feed from their old studios to NPR in Washington. So they went up on the satellite, put an NPR satellite receiver out in Jersey, and got back on the AM that way. Well, they wanted, obviously, to have more redundancy this time around. So from the new location, they can hit both sites by microwave, which gives them a little bit more protection if anything happens.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So the FMs are on Empire, so this is where Chris has been working overnights, where so many other FMs in New York City are, right? They're combined into that master antenna?
That is pretty much where every significant FM in New York City is these days, at least for a main site. All the stations that had been on the Trade Center in days gone by, and there were only four of them, have moved to Empire now and are located at Empire. And then there's that very significant backup site now, that auxiliary site at Four Times Square, that John Lyons runs that has backups for WNYC, among other stations. All Clear Channel stations have backups that are located there. I think SBS has its backups there, and there are a couple others. One of the stations that was a trade, WKCR, the Columbia University station, now has its main at Four Times Square.
Chris, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say it's the digital TV stations are up at Four Times Square as well. It's not just radio.
This is true.
DTV.
You know, a few years ago, John Lyons gave a group of us a tour of Four Times Square, and a very beautiful site, just an amazingly well-engineered facility, and a pretty good location to be broadcasting from, especially if there's a problem at Empire. But you know what they were doing the day that we got the tour of the roof and the antenna area? They were filming outside shots of the buildings for Spider-Man 3. Yeah. And so and they have this camera on a boom way out away from the building where none of the stars of the movie are there. They're just shooting these exterior shots. So my memories of Four Times Square are about as much about the Spider-Man filming. By the way, from the top of Four Times Square, you can get some awesome pictures of the Empire State Building.
This is true. It annoys John every time I'm up there because I'm over by the ledge of his building taking shots of Empire, and I have to reassure him every time I do that. Don't worry, when I'm over at Empire, I'm taking shots of your building. And one of the convenient things, by the way, about all these stations being in Lower Manhattan is that at least for some of them, depending on where the studios are, they actually, I believe WNYC does this, the same microwave shot that hits Empire from where they are. I think the beam width is just wide enough that they're hitting Four Times Square from the same STL transmitter, if I'm not mistaken, so it makes their life a little bit easier in that respect.
Yeah, you can. You can do that. You definitely can.
So, Scott, let's move on, if we could, to some tower news. If people subscribe to or go to your website, they see there's been a few accidents and tower falls here and there. But what really is your focus on towers? You're interested in the historical aspects and lately, let me ask kind of a two-parter question. In the recent past, what interesting tower sites have you been to? What's been noteworthy that you've seen?
There have been some very interesting ones that I've been to. I actually just got back. I was down almost to Chris's neck of the woods last week. A friend of mine, Mike Fitzpatrick, who does another tower site called Necrat.com, NECRAT.com, called me up and he said, you know what, I'm going to take my four-wheel drive and go up and see some of the mountaintops in the Hudson Valley, go up to Mount Beacon and Illinois Mountain. And so we had a chance to get up there. There's actually a site, it's about 50 miles north of Manhattan, overlooking the town of Beacon. That is a fantastic vista over the whole Hudson Valley and very significant in broadcasting history because it actually was home to an AM station as early as the late 20s before they really understood that, no, you don't want these up on a rocky mountaintop. You want them down by the river. But there was an AM station there that was called WOKO that eventually moved north to Albany. And it's been home to FM and then to TV as well since the 40s. So getting a chance to soak up some of that history, and that'll show up on the site sooner or later. Chris had mentioned digital TV, and we're coming up now, or I guess we're just past the one-year mark on the DTV conversion. So I was spending some time around this time last year chronicling some of the analog TV facilities that were going away, some of the stations in New York. I spent a couple of days in Chicago visiting those. I followed very, very closely last winter when Mount Wilson was burning and all the problems they've had since then in L.A. with keeping access available up there, up roads that essentially don't exist anymore.
Because they were washed away
when there were mudslides after the fires. And so engineers now have to drive 2 hours out of their way from L.A. just to get up to the site, if they can even get access to it at all. So there's a lot of very quiet heroism that goes on, just to keep these signals on the air that I think even a lot of people in the business, if they're not actually the ones up on the mountaintop doing this, never really appreciate. One of the things that I like about doing my site is that because it's read by more than just engineers, it's an opportunity sometimes for the programming guys and the sales guys and the marketing guys to see why their engineer isn't there necessarily at 9 a.m. because, oh yeah, okay, there is all this stuff that has to go on overnight at the transmitters. So I like to think it's a useful communications tool between engineering land and the rest of radio sometimes too.
It helps. It helps. I got a question for you, Scott. In all, and all the time with your website, your travels to transmitter sites, radio studios of that sort. Have you noticed, what would you take away from this over the years with the internet, being another way to deliver audio? That's what we'll say, internet radio, IP making things possible, that what we did traditionally in radio was pretty much a fixed one location off to a radio box on a counter or a Walkman on your waist or in your car radio. How have you seen things change at the sites as you travel around? Because I work with a couple of folks who have been doing radio for about 10 years now, and their perspective is the new, what I call the new radio. And when I talk to them about some of the stuff that's on your website or other things I've done back when I got into the business back in the late early 80s and the 70s, and they're like, you did what? I don't understand. Why would you do that? What have you observed as you travel around? What have you taken away from that? Because I've just seen some new sites that are such totally non-traditional radio that it's like, wow, okay, there's a new thing going on.
One of the things that's amazing to me is how much of the old way of doing stuff is still around out there. It's funny, actually, one of the last sites that I visited on this Hudson Valley trip was a station up in the northern end of the Hudson Valley, a real small market station that's owned by one of the big groups. And here they've got, I think it was an old BE rotary pop board. And over that are three flat screen monitors running profit. So there's some old, there was still a rack of carts on the wall. I think the whole audio over IP revolution, and Kirk obviously can speak to this better than probably any of us, but it's really amazing to see how the construction of these plants has changed and how anything now that's more than about 5 or 6 years old is really sort of functionally obsolete now. The idea that you've just got this one Ethernet pipe connecting what's only a control surface to your audio that's actually going to another part of the building is, I think, going to be even more revolutionary than we realize yet. What I'm not seeing yet, and I kind of expected we'd see more of already, is the idea that you no longer even have a studio that's linked to a specific station. And it's interesting, at least in the bigger markets, that you still have, for instance, in your facility in New York, you've still got separate pods for each radio station. And, of course, there's no technical reason anymore that it has to be like that. So I think Absolutely. We're learning a little bit, as we get away from having to have it that way technically, how it still needs to be socially. And there's a lot of experimenting going on. It's fascinating here in Rochester, for instance, and this is another facility that I intend to feature pretty soon. There was a plant that CBS Radio had built when they consolidated here about 9 or 10 years ago that was state-of-the-art at the time. And CBS sold its cluster here. The cluster got split up. The space got vacated, and Clear Channel, which had been in another building across the street, lost its lease and needed someplace to go. So they moved into the old CBS space. And you'd think, okay, great, a radio station moving into a space that had been used by another radio cluster, they'll be all set. They weren't. They gutted the entire place, and they completely rebuilt because it was two totally different philosophies. The CBS philosophy at the time was stations in pods. So you had one corner of a floor with one station studios and their programming people and salespeople and promotion people all around it. And then the next station was over in the other corner. Clear Channel came in. They said, no, the studios all go in one row here. The salespeople all go in one row here. The engineering all goes in one rack room here. And by the time they got done, they had moved absolutely every wall of that building in order to accommodate their way of doing things. So it's fascinating. And part of this also for me, my dad's an architect. And so kind of seeing it through those eyes too, and understanding some of those challenges of making space work, it's really a fascinating thing. And it's neat to have the opportunity, not being beholden to any one particular company. It gives me the opportunity to pretty much have an entry ticket into just about any facility that I want to go see.
Oh, yeah.
Believe me, that's fun. That right there is worth whatever I spend to drive around and fly around and do this.
The engineer's worried that you're going to go look at the audio processor and write down the settings, right?
You'll notice I only post low-res pictures on the site. If you try to get close enough to see what the settings are or what the meter readings on the transmitter are, you're going to be kind of out of luck on that. But I keep the high-res ones around, and I've always got an open picture policy. If any engineer that I've taken pictures of their site needs it later on, if something happens and they need a reference, I'll shoot it right off to them because I figure it's the least I can do to get it back. Right?
Chris, did you have something else?
Well, somebody mentioned earlier in the chat room about the KFI tower collapse back in, I think it was 2004. Everything we've talked about has been the positive side of the radio tower sites and transmitter studios and all that stuff. How much have you had an opportunity to cover, talk to folks in a situation like the KFI collapse or other, you know, catastrophic, you know, disruptions of business? Nothing fatal, but, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, did you have a chance to check in on that, the KFI?
I sure did. That one was heartbreaking because John Paoli, who was the engineer overseeing that project, had become a good friend of mine, and I was getting these constant email updates from him, not just on the big things. You know, obviously, a lot of people were sending out updates about how the tower construction was coming on. There were a bunch of Southern California engineers who drove by the site on a regular basis, even though it wasn't their site. And I could pretty much count every few days on getting an email from somebody with some pictures attached. But then John would email me with just little things like painting the transmitter building. And he was so excited. There's this decorative tile that surrounds the doorway of the building. The building was built in the 30s. There's this beautiful decorative Mexican-style tile that surrounds the doorway. And he was so thrilled because they had matched the colors of the tiles to repaint the transmitter building. And he was sending me pictures of the building repainted. He was so proud of the whole thing. And so to get the news almost immediately after the second version of the tower was up, I think, that he had suffered a fatal heart attack was just heartbreaking. And I had the chance before NAB finally to get back out there and to see the finished project. And that one also will be showing up. I have to confess at this point I'm a good year behind on putting up some of my pictures. I'm hoping this winter to stop traveling quite so much and actually get caught up on what's up on the site. I know there are a lot of people waiting to see things. But, yeah, getting to see some of those events, I knew a couple of the engineers who had been on the Trade Center at 9/11, and I was just starting the column at that point. So I wasn't as close to them as I probably would be now. But, yeah, you get to know these people. And, you know, as Chris had said earlier, it's a very, very small community. Everybody knows everybody else in any given market. Everybody kind of keeps tabs on everybody else's projects. One of the most fun things that I like to get to do sometimes when I'm visiting a market is people tag along, you know, just to see how everybody else's projects are coming along. When I was in LA before NAB a couple of years ago, I gave a presentation to the SBE chapter out there. And I just happened to mention it. At the time, there was a site that was a long wire antenna on a rooftop, no longer in use anymore. But I happened to mention, I've never seen that. And a hand went up from the back of the audience and said, "That's my site. You want to come see it tomorrow?" I said, "Yes, I do." And the next thing you know, everybody else is tagging along. We ended up with about a dozen people up there on the roof just to see this site before it went away. So it's fun to bring people together, too, who don't always get a chance to. And by the way, free plug, if you want me to come talk to your SBE chapter in my travels, I love doing that. I got a fun slideshow that a little different from your normal vendor presentation. No offense, Kirk. But it's a fun thing. I've gotten a chance to talk to a lot of chapters around the country, and I hope to talk to more, too.
Hey, the only thing that Scott is selling when he goes to an SBE meeting is he's selling something with a centerfold, and we'll get to that in just a minute. Scott, I wanted to update you. Actually, you may already be aware of this, but it'd be interesting to read something about WSM in Nashville. Yes. After the flooding occurred at the Opryland Hotel where their studios are, they had to move their on-air operations to the transmitter site. And they have a gorgeous transmitter site. This is old Art Deco building with the enormous 700-foot Blaw-Knox diamond-shaped tower behind it. But they had to real quick scramble and assemble a studio at the transmitter site. And now, it's at the moment anyway, it's like old-fashioned radio. You go to the door of the transmitter building and you know, knock on the door and open it up, and right there's the disc jockey, just a few steps away in the center of the transmitter room floor. Have you gotten to see any pictures of that yet?
Yeah, I'd love to get back down there. I did document that site. Watt Harrison, who used to be the engineer there, a fantastic guy, took me around for a tour of there a few years ago. And that's significant, too, of course, because that's one of only two of the really tall Blaw-Knox diamond-shaped towers, which are, I think, the most fabulous radio towers that have ever existed, except maybe for the Armstrong Tower. Certainly the most fabulous AM towers.
Yeah. Well, they're iconic. Yeah, they're absolutely
they
iconic.
I should just give a quick plug here, because yet another of the hats that I wear, I'm also editor of The Radio Journal at theradiojournal.com, which is the outgrowth of the old M Street Journal. And that goes beyond what I do in the Northeast, and that actually covers engineering all over the country. And so, you know, for that, I wrote quite a bit about what was going on at WSM and the recovery effort there, and not just SM. There were a bunch of other stations also that were flooded out in Nashville that are in various degrees of recovery, and just amazing the effort that that's been put into getting those things back on the air down there.
Hey, we Chris asked a moment ago about how the industry has changed with regard to towers and what tower sites may look like, and how maybe they haven't changed much, or maybe they have. And I'm doing my end of the broadcast. I'm actually in Singapore right now, and it's you know, it's evening where you guys are. It's 9 o'clock in the morning here, and we're at a trade show. And yesterday I met with some broadcast engineers from Sri Lanka. And they had an interesting challenge. They had some grant money available to build new studios for educational purposes at some universities in Sri Lanka. But the government absolutely will not give them any kind of frequency, not even 100 milliwatts. They cannot broadcast. So they can do all this work. They can produce shows. The students can learn about producing radio content, but they can't broadcast over the air. So we worked out a plan to, well, let's just use Wi-Fi. Let's put some, you know, let's just stream your stream on your campus LAN, and let's put some wired streaming radios in a few strategic locations like the canteen and the student lounge and places like this. And then, let's use the Wi-Fi network on the campus, which apparently is quite good. So we were thinking about, what kind of portable Wi-Fi radio listening devices there are. And it occurred to us, well, gee, the iPod Touch. Can do exactly this. You can install an app that will let you listen. A good app, for example, is one called Tuner 2, T-U-N-E-R, and the number 2, Tuner 2. And I use this app to listen to my own radio stations over Wi-Fi. It's a great little app written by a friend of mine, Greg Oganowski. So that kind of became the answer for, you know, for small casting, you know, for broadcasting over just a very selected area. Do you think we're going to see more of this kind of thing, and you know, the new tower is going to be the Wi-Fi hotspot?
Don't ask a public radio engineer that question right now. There's still that fight brewing there over those comments that the head of NPR made that may or may not have been misinterpreted, that the era of the broadcast tower might be over in 5 or 10 years. I think that's still ahead of the curve. Count me in as something of a skeptic on this, only because I think that the wireless companies are not going to be that generous with their bandwidth. Even if you believe that there's going to be some sort of magic advancement in compression technology that will allow for enough spectrum to do all these one-to-one connections, I don't think the wireless companies are in any kind of mood to make it economical for you to sit there and use your phone the way that we use our radio now without making it expensive at the same time. And I'm still a very big believer in the efficiency and the economy of having one transmitter that could potentially, if you put it in the middle of Manhattan, hit 8 million, 10 million, 20 million people from one single site. I think that's pretty cool. I think if somebody invented that right now, if that weren't technology that had been around for 80 or 90 years, that people would be looking at it and saying, wow, there's a breakthrough. And I think the fact that we're so accustomed to it makes it perhaps less exciting than it would be otherwise. I think we're inclined to look at it and say, well, that's old technology. I still think there's a lot of value to that. I'm a big believer in general in old-fashioned mass media.
Well, absolutely, and you make excellent points. In the Sri Lanka situation, granted, it was their own campus Wi-Fi network and not going through another provider. It was all going to be local to the campus, and you know, with lots of wired bandwidth to the access points. But yeah, on a larger scale. Sure, radio bandwidth is finite, and we can only at the moment squeeze so many bits per hertz out of that RF equation. I'm sure over time the wireless companies will be asking for more and more and more bandwidth, and in fact they are, and the TV broadcasters being asked to give some up. But that's a whole nother show. Hey guys, we probably need to wrap this up. I want to give Chris, do you have any last minute questions before we give Scott an opportunity to talk about the calendar?
No, go to the calendar. Got to do the calendar. That's a hot spot.
All right.
Hot topic.
All right.
Absolutely.
To the centerfold. Scott, you published this lovely calendar. I've usually had one on my wall. I think I'm missing one right now.
I moved my head out of the way. You can see it there hanging on the wall.
Oh, yeah. Right, okay. Me. And you feature a tower site every month.
There is a different tower site every month. And I'm just in the midst right now of picking out what's going to be in the 2011 calendar. It typically comes out right around Labor Day every year. So the 2011 calendar is now deep into production. I've got some neat sites from my travels. I try to get sort of a geographic balance in there to make sure the West Coast guys are represented, the Midwest, the East Coast, try to throw a bone to the Southerners whenever possible. And
hey, I got
down there as often as I should.
How do you pick what towers are worthy to go in this calendar? Because I mean, are you looking for a broad middle? Are you looking for ample guy anchor points? You know, just what are the criteria for the visual aspects of these towers?
It helps to be distinctive against the sky. First of all, it helps to catch it at a good time of year. And so most of my travel tends to be concentrated spring and summer when I've got a good chance of getting a nice, pretty blue sky day to go behind the towers. I like sometimes to find transmitter sites with interesting old Art Deco transmitter buildings. Those AM stations that have survived from the 30s or 40s sometimes have transmitter buildings that are as interesting as the towers behind them. I try to get a balance in there between the AM stations and the FM and TV sites. So we'll get some directional arrays, we'll get some tall FM towers. There are some unusual tower designs out there. There's star towers, and there are not many of them out there. There's one in Washington, D.C., there's one in Cincinnati, one in Roanoke that are those unusual pre-stressed towers with the curving support elements to them, those odd-looking self-supporters. I always love to get those in there when I can. And to balance it out with some history in there, too, if there's a tower with a significant anniversary, for instance, coming up, we'll try to get that in there. So it's always kind of a balance. Figure out what's going to go in every year, and it's fun, too. I get a kick out of it.
So if folks want a 2010 calendar, it looks like they can still get those. And your calendar for next year, you can probably pre-order that, I suppose. Would that be at fivebush.com/calendar?
It sure would. We have some of the back issues still available, too. A few of them have sold out. The 2010s are getting close. There's still a few left. But yeah, we encourage people, go ahead and we'll get the ordering going pretty soon for the 2011 as well. And I can promise you, even if I can't say for certain what's going to be in it yet, it's going to be another neat one. I'm sure of that.
All right, good. Well, I look forward to ordering mine. I usually end up just slipping a $20 bill on the NAB show floor. So I'll see if I can actually get one ordered, through the website. Hey guys, we got
to
wrap it up.
Make it to the radio show this fall. I'll have them there.
Oh, okay, good. And the radio show is in what city this year?
Washington, D.C. at the end of September this year. It's a joint project this year, I guess, between NAB, the Radio Advertising Bureau. I don't think anybody knows exactly what to expect this year, but it'll be interesting.
Gotcha. Good deal. Scott Feibusch, thanks for being our guest on This Week in Radio Tech this week. We will have you back on again sometime down the road for another update. I really encourage folks to go read that WNYC article. So go to feibusch.com and check that out. It is interesting. And Scott, being a journalist, does a good job of chronicling what's going on there. Hey, Chris Tobin, thank you for joining us this week. We sure appreciate you being here.
Anytime. It was a great time talking. It's great talking with Scott. It's just a wealth of information. Trust me, the calendar is just the tip of the iceberg.
And next week, we hope to have Mr. Tarr and Mr. Ray back. Mr. Ray is on jury duty, so he's I'm sure the word guilty is on his lips somewhere. And Chris Tarr's a little under the weather. We wish him well. Hey, that's it for This Week in Radio Tech. Remember, you can subscribe to This Week in Radio Tech, the audio version of the podcast, by going to the iTunes store and searching for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T. There's a couple of them there. I think it's pretty obvious which one is ours. You can subscribe that way. There's an RSS feed button on the website, and the website is This Week in radiotech.com. Hey, thanks for being with us. If you have show ideas, topic ideas, or people that you'd like us to interview, you're very welcome to put those on the website in the Speak Up forum or send us an email. Not so hard to find. Thanks a lot for being around, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.